It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking to a guest who says the United States is overreacting to the risk of attack from Al-Qaeda.
But first, we look at a major change that's currently underway and where and how we choose to live.
For years, suburbs dominated the American landscape and were the focus of the American dream. As a nation that traditionally valued privacy, individualism, the American suburb has thrived. Our next guest says that's changing and more Americans simply don't want to live out in the burbs anymore. So what does that mean for the future of suburbs and for cities, too?
Lee Gallagher is the assistant managing editor at Fortune and the author of The End of Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it seems that a house in the suburbs with a white picket fence and a dog in the yard, maybe 2.3 children, seem to epitomize the American dream for the longest time. What's happening now?
What's happening is that thanks to a number of forces ranging from the increasing price of energy to pretty significant demographic changes that are kind of rewiring the makeup of the average household, what we're seeing is that there is a change in the positioning of American suburbia, which for so long was this sort of iconic cultural pillar of American culture, really. And people, more and more people don't want to live there anymore. More and more people are leaving the suburbs for cities or even just for more urban suburbs. And these trends that I document in the book are really just starting and they're only going to accelerate. So this doesn't mean that everyone is going to rush and live in a skyscraper in Manhattan. That's not true. I mean, people do like to live in houses and they do like to have a little bit of space. But what they don't like are the kind of punishing commutes that we've put people in and the sort of urban sprawl. I mean, the American suburbs have morphed over the decades from something that resembled Wonder Years, if you remember that, so the
yes.
sort of sepia-toned memories of suburbia, to what I like to say, to Weeds, the Showtime TV show about people living in cookie-cutter suburbs in the West where the whole point of it, the whole spoof of it was that everyone looked the same, dressed the same, and that may be an exaggeration, but not as much as you would think.
Well, let's go back in time a little bit. If you could explain the evolution of suburbs, where did they first develop in the United States?
Well, the very first suburbs really kind of sprouted organically around railroad stations and then streetcar stations. So when the only transit available was public transportation, the railroad and the streetcar, the suburbs were limited by geography. They had to be within a reasonable walking distance of the point of transit. So as a result of that, the development was much more sort of organic and based around human needs. So if you're getting to the store on foot, you really want all the stores to be next to each other. And, you know, there were some apartments over those stores. And the result was this sort of village-oriented community that had, yes, big, beautiful houses outside that, but there was a grounded center. And many of the kind of best-positioned suburbs these days are those older suburbs, which you see all over the country, not just in the Northeast. They're really everywhere. But they were built on a different kind of DNA, a different kind of blueprint. And then what happened was after World War II, the suburbs underwent tremendous change that was driven by many things, including federal housing policy, which gave a lot of low interest, zero interest, zero money down loans to the millions of returning GIs coming back from the war. At the same time, the Federal Highway Bill put in place the funding for 41,000 miles of highway, and we had this newfound wonder and fascination with the car, and also with mass production on the home building industry side of things. And all these sort of pieces formed the perfect, you know, example, the first perfect setting for the explosion of the modern-day suburbs, which looked very, very different from the old original ones. The older ones were built on a more traditional urban planning, usually a grid-based design, and the newer ones were suddenly They had cul-de-sacs and subdivisions and zoning laws that were completely different and sort of separated everything so that the shops were in one place, the grocery store was in another place, the offices were in another place, and your house was in another place, and you had to use your wonderful car to get around from one place to the other. The newer suburbs were really designed around the car whereas the older suburbs were designed around around people, really.
Mm-hmm. Another anecdotal observation that I have is that it seems that the older homes and older suburbs have very unique houses. Every house is different. But if you look at the newer ones, and I'm kind of generalizing, but a lot of newer developments have very similar, almost identical homes next to each other.
That's true. I mean, the home building industry really changed over the years and became, the home building industry is hyper efficient, and they have gotten things down to a point where they, you know, it's much cheaper and it's much easier to finance if everything is done the same way. You know, home builders will have, they'll have several different models of a certain kind of home, but that is what is easiest and fastest for them to do. And, you know, there are certain people that like that. New homes in particular, I mean, it's funny. I explored this a lot in the book. I personally tend to like older homes. I think they're charming. I like the structure. I like old stone. But I'm in the minority. Most people in this country, people really like the idea of a new home. That has a lot of appeal. That's why new homes tend to be priced higher. And they're, you know, the home building industry, of course, loves this. They just keep turning them out. But one of the interesting things that we're seeing is that there's been a slight shift. I talked to some academics in the book who have done some research on this to show that old homes now are retaining their value in slightly higher levels than new homes in some places. And even that the age of a neighborhood and what decade the houses were built there's sort of a correlation in housing valuations with the age that is slightly different from the way it used to work. So the age of a neighborhood will tell you a lot of things. It'll tell you how it's built. It'll tell you you know, what kind of community you can kind of expect, because the pre-war and post-war communities just look completely different from each other.
Are the preferences for newer houses, I'm wondering where that's coming from and whether it might be more out of a practical concern that I'll have to put less money into things like maintenance of old infrastructure if I get a newer home.
That's part of it. But a lot of people just also like the fact that they're the very first people living in the house. I mean, I did a lot of research around this, and I talked to a lot of housing experts and economists, and that plays a huge role. It's you're not inheriting anybody else's, you know, problems with the house or even energy. I mean, you're the first person that's touched everything in that house, and so people really like that. And, of course, the home building industry loves that. So, but even in newer homes these days, home builders are starting to change the way they build homes to adjust to a housing market that is changing in terms of what consumers are asking for and in terms of some of the demographic trends that we're seeing. So one example of that is that home builders are starting to build multi-generation homes that have an extra wing or unit attached with maybe a separate entrance that could house either an in-law or maybe a millennial child who hasn't yet fully launched out of the house yet, but is an adult.
Hmm.
So they are responding, and the home building industry is also starting to make some changes to their floor plans a little bit. They're getting a little smaller, but they will never use the word small. They call them right-sized, but they're really interested in making people be able to use more of the space in their house. I think one of the things that everyone would agree on is that there was a lot of wasted space built into homes. People don't even really use their living rooms and dining rooms that much, and there's more of a preference now for a sort of open, great room. But even just efficiencies all throughout the house, that means that the people living there will actually use more of the space in it instead of just, you know, paying and living in that, having that space but not really using it.
So how did the Great Recession of 2008 affect the suburbs?
You know, the housing crisis that we went through was predominantly, it impacted the whole country, but it disproportionately impacted the suburbs because that's where the U.S. home building business does most of its business, and because that's where most Americans live, and that's also where most of the expansion happened. So it was the drive to you qualify era where anybody could get a loan. If you couldn't afford the house for $300,000 that was 30 miles from the city, you could afford the house that was $150,000 that was 50 miles from the city. And so you saw a lot of people going to really, really great distances to have a piece of the American dream, to have these houses that they could finally get the loans for. And so, of course, when that went away, those furthest out were hit the hardest. And they were hit not only from not being able to afford their homes, but the cost of transportation to get to and from those houses is dramatic. I mean, I have a whole chapter in my book about the suburbs and the car and the relationship between the suburbs and the car. And in the exurbs, that's where you saw the most, just the, you know, I quote a couple studies that show that for many people, especially those living out in those remote areas, they would be spending a greater percentage of their monthly income on their cost of transportation than on their cost of housing itself. So that's anathema to a lot of people. You don't really think about that, but the car and the commute is a huge part of life, especially in those remote suburbs.
We're talking with Lee Gallagher. She's the author of The End of Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. We're talking about the shift away from the American suburbs, and we want to know what you think. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll take your calls coming up after the break. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're talking with Lee Gallagher about her new book, The End of Suburbs, and we want to hear from you.
Do you live in the suburbs? What do you like or dislike about it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
Lee, can you talk a little bit about how changing family structures play into suburban decline?
Sure. You know, the suburbs were really born at a time when the traditional nuclear family was the backbone of the middle class and was the predominant household type in America, and was the case for many years. But we're starting to see a lot of changes to the whole notion of the nuclear family. Number one, the birth rate is going down in this country quite dramatically. And what that means is that there are fewer families with young children, which were the bread and butter of suburbia. So you can see this playing out. I write in the book about how my father grew up in a suburb, inner ring suburb outside of Philadelphia called Drexel Hill. And he was, at the time, growing up in the 1950s, he counted there were 41 children on just his block alone. And I decided to see how that would how that translated to today. And so I actually hired a private investigator to go and knock on doors and count the number of children, and it was about 12 to 15, and that's playing out all over the country. And statistically speaking now, you actually have more baby boomers and senior citizens in the suburbs than families with young children today. And that's a pretty dramatic shift, and that's only going to accelerate. And that has a number of implications, because what that means is that the suburbs are aging, and there are more older people living in the suburbs, and that presents a whole host of issues that communities have to deal with. Older people can't always get around as easy, you know, especially when they stop being able to drive. So you're seeing a number of sort of nonprofit groups arise to help people adjust to aging in the suburbs. Here in New York, where I'm based, we have even some of the wealthiest suburbs here have groups called, there's a group called Staying Put in Rye. Rye is a very nice suburb outside of New York City, and it's called Spry. They call themselves Spry. So the communities are really trying to adapt to this. In the suburbs outside of D.C., Washington, D.C., there are some groups, like they organize a 50-plus action plan. And these, you know, older people in the suburbs are going to have quite different concerns as taxpayers than families with young children. They're going to be more interested in transportation issues, or in making traffic signals readable, or other sorts of issues than making sure the schools are wonderful. So this is really going to change the conversation going forward in a pretty significant way in our suburban communities.
Well, and meanwhile, millennials, which are the biggest generation, I believe the earliest millennials are about in their mid-30s right now.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, they're the other billion-dollar question, or the other big seismic shift that's happening, is that they're even bigger than the baby boomers. And so far, they're actually not really launching yet into their own house and forming their own households. Record numbers of them are still living at home with their parents. But when they do, all the preference studies show that they are not going to want to live in that sort of cul-de-sac suburbia, which is where many of them grew up. And now, you know, some people might say, yes, wait until they have children. That they say they want the urban communities now, just wait until they have kids. But really, you know, all the experts seem to think that this is But that's not going to be the case. I mean, even when they sort of settle down, if they do choose to settle down, they will want more walkable, urbanized suburbs. So a big thesis of my book is that the suburbs that will do well will be those that are able to adapt to meet all these trends that I document, and those that are able to sort of urbanize a bit and form grounded sort of centers that are interesting places to be and that are lively and that offer some sense of community. So those suburbs might be able to attract the millennials.
But can you reinvent an existing suburb? I mean, it's already built. How do you make it adapt for the future?
That's a fair question. Many of them are already built, and some of the most remote that are the sort of loopiest, cul-de-sac-iest suburbs are hard to reinvent. But some of them that are built on some of the older bones. I mean, you see a lot of efforts to urbanize suburbs happening all over the country, in places like I cite Morristown, New Jersey, in the book, and there's a tremendous effort underway there. The town has spent about $300 million to sort of bring in condo buildings and yoga studios and fancy restaurants and things that will really appeal to a younger generation and also to people that live there. They don't have to leave. They don't have to go anywhere. But they can have everything they need right in their own town. And that's happening all over the place. You also see the home builders. They're really experimenting with different ways to do this. There are some home builders and developers are building developments that are really in the middle of the suburbs that are just kind of built from scratch, a couple high-rises and some pedestrian walking village beneath it with some retail and some restaurants, built literally from nothing. And that's a different approach, literally creating a new community. Mm-hmm. So it remains to be seen which ones will do better, but the developers and builders are really kind of throwing everything at the wall and just trying to do anything they can to reinvent and to urbanize. And they're using terms that traditionally have not been used in the home building industry. They're talking about the importance of creating a sense of place, which is an expression that a lot of people that are really devout urbanists know, but the home builders have not really talked about that, and now they're starting to. So there's really a big change that's happening.
If there were an icon of today's suburbs in your mind, what would it be?
Do you mean a particular town?
I mean, like when we think about the original or the suburban boom, maybe of the 1950s, we think of the white picket fence and everything. If there were a modern day mark of newer suburbs, what would it be?
Well, I think it would be the older suburbs that have a lot of the things that people are looking for. So I think places like outside of New York here, I would say Montclair, New Jersey, or Hastings on Hudson, they're really, it's sort of like going back to the future because it's these older towns were, you know, they had the formula right a really long time ago, and we just modernized it and messed with it and supersized it. And what people really want are the sort of suburbs that are more human scale and livelier and warmer. I mean, it's funny, the movie Silver Linings Playbook takes place in a suburb outside of Philadelphia, and that is really, it exemplifies a lot of the characteristics that I'm talking about. And so I think that those suburbs are the way of the future.
If suburbs fail, is our country losing something significant about its identity?
You know, I mean, things change over time. I mean, you know, the country has changed, our people have changed, and I don't think it's losing something. I think that it's gaining options. I mean, you know, for people who want to live in a suburb, they will still be able to live in a suburb. But fewer people want to live that way, and more people want other options. So for a really long time, the way that our housing landscape was arranged, you had two options. You had three options. You had cities, suburbs, or rural. And not everybody wants to be put in one of those three buckets. So it was very black and white. And I think what we're going to see is a slightly more sort of choose-your-own-adventure kind of housing pattern, where for people that want something more walkable, there will be something more walkable. And that doesn't have to be living in New York City or living in Chicago or living in Milwaukee. It can be living in a small town or a suburb that offers a lot of amenities and a lot of access to a lot of different things in really close proximity. So I think, you know, my book, the outlook for my book is pretty optimistic considering the title, but I think the future is going to be sort of happier lifestyles, more options for everybody, and these changes are really happening. And so the builders and developers that do well will be the ones that respond to them, and I think it'll mean better options for everybody.
Lee, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Lee Gallagher is the assistant managing editor at Fortune and the author of The End of Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving.
Coming up after the news, we'll be talking to a guest who says the United States is overreacting to potential threats from Al-Qaeda. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a strange, kind of unexpected festival in Wisconsin, a Gator Fest.
But first, we're talking with a guest who says the United States is overreacting to the risk of attack by Al-Qaeda.
The United States shut down almost 24 diplomatic posts in the Middle East last week in response to a terrorist threat. Apparently, American intelligence intercepted a conference call between Al-Qaeda leaders. In the call, there were, again, apparently references to an upcoming attack.
John Mueller is a political scientist at Ohio State University and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's also the co-author of Terror Security and Money, Balancing the Benefits, Costs, and Risks of Homeland Security. He joins us now to discuss why he thinks the Obama administration is overreacting. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So why do you think the U.S. is overreacting to this potential attack?
Well, I can't be really sure, obviously, because you don't have the full information, but these sort of generalized warnings in the past have generally not panned out. There's been a long history of them, particularly during the Bush administration, there's going to be an attack before the next election and so forth. And no attack took place, no attackers were found, and even if the warning deterred an attack, you'd expect an attacker to wait a couple months and then do something. None of that happened, and this seems to fit in this pattern. So unless there's the information that's been out now certainly doesn't suggest the extreme measures that have taken place, which are really quite costly. I'm prepared to be refuted in that if they really do say that there's good information that they're based on, but so far certainly so far the information has been very suggestive that they've overreacted.
Well, and in that instance with President Bush, there were some accusations that he was using the terror threats as a political tool. Do you think there's a potential motivation along those lines with this information?
Well, there may be. I think there may be sort of a Benghazi syndrome going on, that was pretty traumatic for the administration, not only because of the tragedy itself, of course, but also for the high political costs that it entailed and it still entails in many respects. And so it seems sort of suspicious as this whole thing that we have to now protect all our embassies and because we had one attacked, last year and two attacked about 15 years ago in Africa. That's a fairly big extrapolation, but I'd put it more sort of at a position of unwarranted jumpiness. That would be my suspicion, rather than at a sort of conspiracy idea or political idea.
So is it unwarranted, though? I'm thinking about the Benghazi thing because President Obama has really been under a lot of scrutiny for his for that situation as a whole. So is there a double standard there?
Yeah, well, there's the tendency you basically try to shore up the last whatever's in the inbox. So if someone gets on a bomb with a bomb in their underwear, then you suddenly have a big war on underwear or on shoes or whatever. And the most traumatic thing they've had is an attack on an embassy. So therefore, they're very sensitive about protecting embassies. In this case, there seems to be information that something might happen in Yemen, but not in all those other places. So it seems really pretty extreme. The one thing I would say is that Obama administration has actually been really pretty good at toning down the rhetoric compared to the Bush administration, particularly the early Bush administration. He's dropped the global war on terror label, and he's also not spouting things about how three people setting off a bomb someplace presents an existential threat to the United States. So the rhetoric has really improved. So one thing you could say, and I can't refute this one way or the other, is that if they really are concerned about this, it comes from a record in which they have not been issuing a lot of hysterical, panicky proclamations. So that leads me to suspect that maybe there is a lot more to it, but certainly, as I indicated, the information so far doesn't suggest that's the case.
And in your mind, do you feel that the American people are a bit desensitized to this issue? Even if you think back to the Bush administration, we had the color scale to tell us, you know, it's an orange level, it's a red level. So when we hear about threats today, are we taking them as seriously as we should?
We maybe take them too seriously, given the amount of damage that terrorists do. An American's chance of being killed by terrorism is about 1 in 3.5 million per year. Chance of being killed in an automobile crash is about 1 in 8,000 per year. And so it should be put in that sort of context. It doesn't mean there's no problem, but it's not exactly a major one. And so there may be a certain amount of desensitization. There's certainly a lot of cynicism about this, you know, in the press and in comments and articles in the press. And so that may be something of a change from the olden days where people got more hysterical. But basically, the principle should be scaring people without good reason is a really bad policy, because fear, you know, has bad health consequences, can be very disruptive. In this case, the main costs probably are from just the evacuations of embassies and so forth, and the costs and difficulties for those people directly. There's no fear, I suppose, within the United States, since none of the threats in this case seem to embody concerns about something that might happen in the United States itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we shutter the doors of embassies around the world, what kind of message is it sending to the jihadists and other terror groups like Al-Qaeda, and what are they thinking?
Well, one thing, in fact, there's been a few sort of blogs and stuff on this from some of the jihadists. They're sort of celebrating in the sense that all you have to do is, you know, have a bit of chatter on the Internet, and the United States, you know, launches into these self-destructive antics. And so that's probably going to encourage them to do even more of this. The fact that they should surely be aware, even before the NSA revelations, that all their communications are being scrutinized as much as possible, means that, well, if they're going to be listening to us, maybe we should give them something to listen to. So the possibility of a whole lot of disinformation, so-called chatter and so forth, is certainly out there. But I don't think that's really a brand new thing for them. I mean, Osama bin Laden said about 2004, you know, it's really crazy. Basically, all we have to do is go to some country and wave a flag and scream Al-Qaeda, and the United States comes down on that area like a ton of bricks. You know, we're going to bankrupt the United States. So this way, all we have to do is sort of run around and shout a few places. That's obviously a considerable exaggeration, but the basic idea that overreaction helps, you know, plays into the terrorist hands and is also extremely costly is sound. In the book Terror, Security, and Money, we try to calculate how much money has been spent, increased spending on funding on security for the United States since 9/11. And this is just a domestic. It doesn't have anything to do with the wars overseas. And there's over $1 trillion of increased expenditures over the levels that were in place on 9/11. That's a very large amount of money, obviously, and it has not really been very carefully scrutinized, including by the Obama administration.
Hmm. So, well, going back to what you were saying about overhearing some chatter, quote unquote, those are your words. I'm wondering, how do we know, though, that we're overreacting or that it is just a bit of chatter? That's what we've been told, that they've intercepted this telephone conversation. But we don't know the extent of it. And the only people who do seem to be the terrorists themselves and the person who was tapping that wire.
Yeah, just the track record is pretty bad. I mean, if you look at some intelligence reports after 9/11, intelligence was telling people that we think there's between 2,000 and 5,000 Al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. The number that has been found is probably definitely extremely close to zero. And you had John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, saying that Al-Qaeda is going to attack by the end of the year. We heard all this chatter and so forth, and their preparations are 90% complete, and nothing ever came of it. So there's been a lot of this proclamation going on all the way back to 2001, and very little of it has panned out to mean much of anything. There have been attacks, just a handful, of course, including obviously the thing in Boston recently, but that didn't have anything to do with the warnings or anything. Just a few people got together and eventually set off a bomb or did some shooting.
So do you think the administration's reaction to this will be perceived as weak to our foreign allies?
Yeah, it might be either weak or hysterical or irresponsible. That would be the danger, or foolish. Obviously, if it turns out that they're really onto something big and they're able to foil it, then the administration will look pretty good. But barring that, it's probably not going to be their best move from a public relations standpoint.
So in your mind, what is the appropriate reaction to threats like these?
Well, generally speaking, if you've got really good intelligence, you should get it as good as possible and then move on it. And they frequently have done that. They've broken up a lot of plots who are sort of moving along, both in this country and overseas. That doesn't take a lot of it. You don't make big public pronouncements about it. You simply basically arrest these guys, and then you hold a press conference and explain what you've done. That doesn't really scare people. It's not empty warnings saying that, you know, you have to look everywhere and worry about, you know, over your shoulder all the time. It doesn't exaggerate the threat. It just simply shows what they've got. So issuing broad threats, warnings, rather, that are very inspecific, like there's something going to happen, we don't know where or when or how or who, not productive. I mean, if people hear the warnings, they can become afraid, but there's no information about what they could do because you don't know what the target is going to be. So working on operable intelligence is a good idea, but just sort of broad warnings do not seem to be very productive of anything.
Well, thank you, John, so much for shedding some light on that. That was John Mueller. He's a political scientist at Ohio State University and senior fellow at the Cato Institute.
Coming up, we'll look at Wisconsin's annual Gator Fest. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time now for another installment of Curious Wisconsin, where we answer the little mysteries you might encounter as you travel through the state.
This question comes from Paul Erickson of UW-Platteville. He joined us a while back to tell us that the big M on a hill near Platteville stands for mining.
His question was, why does the town of Leon, which is near Sparta, have an annual Gator Fest when Wisconsin is not really alligator territory? We called up Gator Fest founder Sharon Folsey to find out.
Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, I know there aren't a lot of alligators in Wisconsin. What gave you the idea to have a Gator Fest in Leon?
Well, first of all, Leon, Wisconsin is just 3 miles south of Sparta, and it's a really small town. We have maybe 25 houses. You know, it's not a very big place. So, yeah, my daughter was visiting in Florida in May of 2002, picked up a newspaper that had said that Leon, Wisconsin was in an uproar because they had a pet alligator that kept getting loose.
Okay.
And it said that they did a petition, the health inspector was called, they mandated that this family build a 6-foot-high fence. I mean, it was really a long thing about Leon, Wisconsin, having alligators. Well, we don't have a health inspector, we don't have a petition, and we don't even have a 6-foot-high fence. So I know we didn't have gators.
All right.
I sent USA Today a letter explaining all of this, and they basically sent me a letter back saying, no, they were correct, they stood by their reporting, and we were wrong. So a group of us women were sitting around talking one night and decided, well, hey, if they say we got gators, let's have some gators. So there was a band at that time out of Green Bay Area called Otis and the Alligators. So we were just going to book that band and have it down behind the local pub and just have music, and that was it.
Well, I got to ask you, you were sitting around talking. Was alcohol involved in the decision to go after a Gator Fest?
Well, of course. And it was a bunch of women talking, too, you know, which sometimes, you know, guys think we come up with some pretty goofy ideas.
So you went after the Gator Band. How did that pan out?
Well, we were going to do it in August, and we booked it, And then in July, they called and said that their band was disbanded. They no longer had a band. Oh, my goodness. Then what are we going to do? So we had to dream up some other activities to do besides just music. So that's how the whole celebration got started. And we decided to have a parade, but Leon doesn't have a street that's long enough to have a parade. So our parade stands still, and the people have to walk by. We also were going to have a ball tournament because softball is big in rural communities. But we thought we'd do it differently, and all of the players have to use plastic laundry baskets instead of gloves. So that turned out to be a real popular event. We now have 3 days of ball tournament, laundry basket softball tournament, and it's full every year. Just a real big hit.
Now, with the standstill parade, do people make floats to stand still in the parade?
Oh yes, yeah. They bring their floats. Even Oktoberfest from La Crosse, they bring their big float, you know, with all their music and their dancers. And we have local Cash and Fall Festival. All of the local festivals bring their floats. And then, like people say, it's kind of nice because then the viewers can talk with the people that are on the floats. And like for the fire department and the ambulance, the kids can get up in there and look at everything. So it's just a win-win situation.
Now, this will be the 11th year coming up that you've done Gator Fest.
Yes.
How has it grown over the years? Are people catching on?
Oh, yes. When we started, everybody laughed at us. You know, they thought we were pretty goofy. But every year we try to do something new, a new event, a new activity, so that it's not stagnant, so that it's something new and exciting every time. Now we have food, lots of food, including gator meat. We have
real gator meat.
Yeah, real gator meat. And that's a pot. We sell out of it every year. We have pancake breakfast, you know, the normal things. Plus, we have gator toss, which we sell tennis balls with numbers on, and then a certain time of the day, the people have to throw these tennis balls into this pond. Whoever gets in the middle of the pond wins the money, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of fun activities. This year, we're going to have a kids' tractor pull. We started out having a car show. That didn't go over too well, so now we have a tractor exhibit, farm tractor exhibit,
uh-huh,
with antique tractors. That goes over real good. We have live music, of course, Friday night and Saturday night. That's always popular. Craft show, that's been growing every year. So there's something going on for everybody all 3 days.
A lot of towns have their annual festival, and I think a lot of people really look forward to those. Is this something that you think has helped create an identity in Leon?
Oh, definitely that. Yeah, a lot of people didn't even know where Leon was. And, you know, we would take our float to other parades, and they kept asking, where's Leon? Where's Leon? You know, so, oh, definitely that. We have a lot of people that come back because it's family, you know, they left there and now they're coming back for their reunions or whatever. Plus, we have a lot of new people every year that come. And we do get out there and we promote it quite a bit, too. So it's something different. You know, it's not the normal run of festivals. And just now, this past week, Malvina, which is located just a few miles south of Leon, had their frog jumping days. So we got frogs in Malvina, and then we got black squirrel days in Norwalk or Wilton, and then, of course, gators in Leon. So we got a lot of animals.
But there are still no real alligators in Leon, no matter what the USA Today tries to tell us.
Right. Well, we get the La Crosse Area Herpetological Society to bring over their reptile exhibit, and they bring a little gator with them.
All right,
so
okay.
We always have a gator.
All right. Well, anything you're looking forward to at the event this year?
Good weather. We've never been rained out. Never been rained out. We've got 23 entries in our parade, so unless we extend the street, that's as many as we can put in there. And everything's ready to go.
Are you going to be in the parade?
Oh, I have to be the part of the chairman that gets it lined up. So
Gotcha.
Last year I was the parade marshal. Oh, that's another thing we do. We have a parade marshal every year. The first year we had three of them. You know, we got such a big parade, we had to have three marshals. Now we have two, at least two. So that's always kind of fun, too, because those are usually pillars of our community, you know, that we select to be parade marshals. So, yeah, it's
and
fun.
And then when you're done, do you wind up at the tavern where it all started?
No, we usually end up there at the beer hall at the Gator Fest, you know, we have meetings at the tavern and we still get them involved, and the Tavern League always has their float in the parade, so we keep everybody going.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Sharon. I appreciate
it. No problem. Thank you.
That was Sharon Folsey, founder of Gator Fest in Leon, Wisconsin. It takes place August 23rd through the 25th.
That was our Curious Wisconsin segment. Is there something you're curious about in Wisconsin? Email your question to centraltime@wpr.org or call our toll-free hotline. The number is 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. We'll try to answer your question on a future show.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, joins us to round up the top state news of the week.
And a new book encourages us to do cool stuff. I cleaned up the language there.
And we'll hear how we can subscribe to a regular sampling of art.
That's tomorrow on Central Time.